You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Remix of the Day.
BFM News.
Kia ora, good afternoon. I'm Adam Jacobson. It's 12 o'clock. Both National and Labor approached the election with similar views on development. The New Zealand Planning Institute will host its annual conference next month, and for the first time there will be a political forum discussing the importance of planning issues. CEO of the Planning Institute, David Curtis, expects both Labor and National to be focusing heavily on development this election.
National would consider their approach would be more around favouring development. However, I think around this area, particularly at the moment, Labor would probably have a fairly similar view simply because of the pressures that are facing the country at the moment.
Other parties that will also be attending the event will be the Green Party, the Māori Party and NZ First. Productivity figures released by Statistics New Zealand show New Zealand is falling behind Australia. The figures show labour productivity growth in Australia has increased by 2.2% a year, compared with the 1.3% a year in New Zealand. Dunedin North Labour MP David Clark says Australia's higher minimum wage puts them far ahead of New Zealand.
We know already that Australians have to work about 4 days a week to take home the same amount of pay that Kiwis earn in 5 days a week. It's a pretty sobering statistic, and it does point to a failure of leadership on behalf of the government for making sure our economy is delivering for every New Zealander.
Clark says it's time for a government that will support employers who will invest in higher productivity equipment. In international news, investigative journalists for Al Jazeera have released a report detailing cases of sexual abuse by United Nations peacekeepers around the world. The report follows a recent admission by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres that 145 cases of sexual abuse and assault had taken place across all UN peace missions in 2016. Al Jazeera alleges these incidences had been covered up and mishandled, leaving the victims to deal with trauma on their own. Countries with the highest number of alleged assaults include Haiti, the Central African Republic, the Dominican Republic of the Congo, and South Sudan. A United States Army general is calling for a strengthened and modernized nuclear deterrent force. Air Force Lieutenant General Jack Weinstein expressed concerns over what he described as a much more aggressively behaved Russia in recent years. General Weinstein has accused Russia of violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a pact which both parties agreed to reduce their nuclear arsenals. These comments come in stark contrast to the Obama administration, who made it a priority to eliminate nuclear weapons. And finally, artificial lungs and backpacks may be the saving grace for those who suffered lung failure. The device has been tested successfully on sheep and has been confirmed for human trial. The machine works by pumping their blood through a gas exchanger to provide oxygen and remove carbon dioxide. People with lung failure are usually connected to a machine, but they are often bulky and leave them confined to a bed. And that's the news.
Sleet, low-pressure systems, depressions and more in this 95BFM weather update, thanks to ProGear.
Your forecast for Thursday the 23rd of March, cloudy with some morning drizzle, then mostly clearing in the afternoon. Southwesterly winds, a high of 24 degrees, an overnight low of 14 degrees. Sunset today is at 7:30 p.m. Your outlook for the rest of the week, Friday, increasingly cloudy with some chance of showers developing, light winds. Saturday, cloudy with some showers, a northeasterly. Sunday, partly cloudy with some showers, strengthening northeasterly. That's your news and weather. I'm Adam Jacobson. The time is 12:04.
Are you wearing the right amount of layers? I hope so. That was a 95BFM weather update. Thanks to ProGear. Unparalleled quality and professional photographics. Online at progear.co.nz.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jōgai tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora. Welcome to The Wire for Thursday, the 23rd of March. It's Jōgai here, your host.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
coming up on the show today. My producer Jess catches up with Manu Keddie from Hikurangi Enterprises to learn more about the industrial hemp growing trial that's now ready for harvest. We have Andrew Little live in studio for our weekly chat. Jess also has a report on the government's plan to oil drill in 35.5% of the North Island's Maui Dolphin Sanctuary. And I speak to the research manager of the Institute of Culture, Discourse and Communication at AUT, Dr. Philippa Smith, to gain a more critical understanding of what makes the Bachelor tick. And our news director, Shemena Smith, has a chat to the chief executive of New Zealand Tech, Graham Muller, about a concept called the Internet of Things. If you have any thoughts throughout the show, please get in contact by calling 309 3879 or text in on 5395.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
A secret Ruatoria hemp trial planted in December is ready for harvest, and this Friday the community can come and smell, touch, smoke the plant and learn what all the hype is about. Last year, Hikurangi Enterprises secured a license from the Ministry of Health to establish a small trial crop of industrial hemp in Ruatoria this growing season. The possibilities for industrial hemp include foodstuffs, health products, textiles, and as a housing solution. My producer, Jess Smith, spoke to Manu Keddie from Hikurangi Enterprises this morning to learn more about the trial and began by asking about the uses of hemp.
Well, there's heaps of uses, and they go back thousands of years. I guess the most common ones that people know about are in ropes and material and that sort of stuff. I got married 20 years ago in a hemp shoot. And the other, what we're really interested in is the pharmaceutical medical uses of it. There's some great new research that's showing how beneficial it is for pain relief and for addressing a number of health conditions. So we're keen to pursue that. But yeah, people put the seed on their breakfast cereals and, you know, it's said to be a superfood that contains all the essential vitamins and minerals that we need every day. So lots of uses and different purposes, and there's different strains that are grown for those different applications. So the strain that we are growing is this one that's high in CBD, which is a particular extract that's got the medical benefits, and others that are grown for their fibre, so they grow tall and have really long fibre that run through them, and others for the seed. So yeah, it just depends on what you want to use it for.
Awesome, that's really cool. So what's the overall aim for this trial?
Well, we thought we were just planting it to learn how to grow the stuff. So there's about 5,000 plants. We were lucky to get this strain that is quite difficult to access in New Zealand. And we just wanted to test out the conditions, the climate and that sort of stuff of where we grow. I mean, there's plenty of the illicit version that grows around our area. Mm-hmm. So we know that it grows well here, but wanted to see how this particular strain went in the area that we were growing in. And yeah, it did really well. We had a really dry summer, it was pretty much drought, and we only watered it for the first few days, and after that it was fine and it kept growing well. So it's been a good season, and it, as it turns out, yeah, so that was the purpose, was just to learn how to grow the stuff. We put it under some shade cloth so that the birds couldn't get it because they really like the seed. And it's in an area where there's pigs and other wildlife around, so we had to sort of fence it off. And there's a lot of rules around where you can and can't plant it and things from the government. But yeah, so that's what we thought we were doing. But after sort of word got out, there's a number of buyers that are interested. And I just had a phone call this morning from a guy who suffers from chronic pain, who's really keen to get some. Unfortunately, our license doesn't let us supply him at the moment. But we're keen to. We've been working with some scientists and researchers in New Zealand and overseas, and hope to get some products into clinical trials this year so that we can get it out there. And there's still sort of a lot of regulation around it, but those rules seem to be changing fairly rapidly, and there's a good chance that hemp, that the low THC hemp, will be able to be deregulated later this year. There's a committee that controls the medicines or makes recommendations to the minister about what medicines should be and shouldn't be regulated and controlled. And at the moment, the hemp, even though it's got no or very low THC still was classified as a restricted medicine, but that may be changing soon.
Yeah, and so the hemp is now ready for harvest, and on Friday I've read that the community can come and touch, smell and smoke the plant. I'm sure a lot of people are curious, what effects does smoking hemp have?
I've heard it can give you a headache if you smoke too much of it, and we've had the plants tested. They came out at less than 0.1% THC, so the line goes that you'd need to smoke a joint the size of a power pole to get a hit from it. Mm-hmm. And before you did that, your lungs will probably give out, I imagine. So, there's very little, there's no psychoactive response that you get from smoking it. And, probably, I don't know, if it might be a placebo or something, potentially. So, so smoking it, offering people to smoke it is just to demonstrate that it doesn't do anything. We had a bit of feedback from some of the local growers of the illicit variety who are concerned about the cross-pollination issue.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a real risk both for them and for us. Mm-hmm. If we get their THC crops pollinating with ours, then it raises the THC levels and means that we'd have to destroy our mm-hmm. crops. So we've had to be careful about where we planted this lot, but we've had offers from a lot of landowners that are keen to plant next season. And we'll just need to negotiate with the other growers in the area to make sure that we're far enough away. But the pollen can travel for 5 kilometres. So,
oh, wow.
It's an issue that we'll have to work through in time.
Interesting. So what are the next steps for the trial now that it's ready for harvest?
Yeah, so Friday the community will come and basically we're going to pull up the whole plant. We understand there's some stuff we might be able to do with the roots, and also got an email yesterday from a local brewery that want to produce a hemp beer.
Oh, cool.
So I'm just talking to the Ministry of Health about the rules around us giving them the leaf mm-hmm. to do that, and maybe some of the flowers, the female flowers. We'll dry the stuff and take the seed and save some of that for replanting. We'll cold press some of it for oil. And the husk cell, the envelope that the seed sits in, is where the high CBD content is. So that's the stuff that we'll be keen to put through an extraction process and turn into a product that can be put into some trials later in the year, hopefully, with some independent medical researchers that can take it through that process and just validate some of the anecdotal or some of the evidence overseas where the crop is already legal and people have been able to do research much more freely than we can in New Zealand at the moment.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Yes, that was my producer, Jess, speaking to Manu Caddy from Hikurangi Enterprises about their industrial hemp growth. We're just going to have a little break now, but we'll be back with Andrew Little for our weekly chat.
It's music.
95.
Original Originator, 95 BFM. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95BFM.com.
Drive, call the garden, let it know it's gonna grow, fill up your ride.
why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Hi, we are back, and we have leader of the Labour Party, Andrew Little, live in studio with us. Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
I'm very good. Yeah, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
Fantastic.
So, Nikki Hager and John Stevenson's joint collaboration, Hit and Run, was released this Tuesday, and the book details an NZSAS raid gone wrong in Afghanistan in 2010, as well as the consequent cover-up. Do you support an investigation into these allegations?
Yes, because part of the story is that after the raid happened, the New Zealand Defence Force, their account of it said that there were no civilian casualties. And even though there was another report afterwards after a complaint that said there were no civilian casualties, it's pretty clear that there were. And I think we need to know what happened, who was in command, and how decisions were made, and why it is that New Zealand troops appear to have been involved in an event that led to such a number of civilian casualties, both fatalities and injuries.
Mm-hmm. What about the notion of a cover-up? Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I mean, it does look like you look at those early releases and some of the messages coming out of the Defence Force. First it was, there are no civilian casualties. Then it was, well, if there are civilian casualties, they're not the responsibility of New Zealand troops. So there was a bit of a shifting story. I mean, I'm reluctant to go as far as saying there's been a cover-up, because who knows who provided what information to whom at what time, sort of thing. I think the book makes it clear and it raises serious allegations and indicates a pretty solid evidential basis for it, which is why I think that for the sake of the reputation of the SAS, of the New Zealand Defence Forces generally, and for New Zealand, because we send deployments overseas, that we do need to know what the truth is, and the government should order an inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And former Defence Minister Wayne Mapp has conceded that some civilians died in the attacks, which is a shift from his position in 2011, where he insisted no civilians died. What do you make of this shift in the position?
Yeah, I mean, he was actually quoted in the book saying that he thought the whole exercise was a disaster and was a fiasco. So he obviously knew enough a few years ago when he first made those comments. Now he's repeated them. I think that makes the case for an independent inquiry even more compelling. Mm-hmm. Clearly some people know something about that exercise, that raid, that has gone horribly wrong and led to civilian casualties. Because, of course, it's not just the fact there were casualties, it was the failure to follow up and provide care and assistance to the injured people, which is, even in wartime, is a responsibility of soldiers.
Right. And Mapp also said that the actions carried out during the raid could not be considered war crimes. Do you agree with this?
Well, I don't think it's for him to say, and I don't think it's for anybody to say until we actually establish what the actual facts are. You know, these events were done at a time of high tension, of a sort of a combat environment, if you like, and weeks after the soldiers involved, the New Zealand soldiers involved, had lost a comrade to a roadside bomb. So, emotions no doubt were running high, and no one can kind of put themselves easily in the position they might have been in. What we do know is that there were civilian casualties, there are serious allegations about alleged failings on the part of our troops, and I think for all our sake and the sake of the reputation of New Zealand and its defence forces, we need to get to the bottom of it, and only an independent inquiry can do that.
Mm-hmm. So we can't really make any substantial sort of calls on it just yet.
I'd be reluctant to go too far. I mean, as I say, I think Nikki Hager and John Stevenson have laid out with some detail a set of facts. No one has come out so far, 48 hours after the publication of the book, to say, no, that's all factually wrong. They've laid out some facts. There are some grey areas. So we know that most of the fatalities were the result of a helicopter gunship that was American, and so piloted by, crewed by Americans. One of the questions is, were they being directed by our troops, our commander on the ground, or were they following American instructions? So there's that sort of thing. And then there's when the insurgent that they did ultimately catch up with and transfer to the Afghanis, they were with, when they arrested him, they were with some Afghani police. Who made the arrest, and therefore does that bring it within kind of wartime conditions, or is it a arrest by a local force? So there are some legal grey areas that is even more reason for why we need an inquiry to know what the truth is and know whether there have been breaches of international law.
Mm-hmm. And moving on, it's also been revealed that Labour's Māori MPs will only be running in their electorates and not on the party's list. What prompted this move?
They came to me as a group some weeks ago and told me that that's what they would like to do. The way the Labour Party operates is our expectation is that every candidate will be on the list, but you can apply for an exemption. We have a reasonably high threshold for it. They put to me the argument that because of the way things are going in the Māori seats, they will have a stronger platform for campaigning on and winning their seats back if they don't look like they have a kind of a parachute of a list placing. So it was their request. It was considered very carefully by the group of us who look at these exemptions, and in the end we agreed to it. We know that they will have a strong campaign. They've got a strong campaign team. It's part of the Labour's overall campaign team, and they're up for it and they want to get into it.
But isn't this kind of condemning the voters in a sense, because it sounds like you're saying if you don't give us your candidate vote, you'll be losing these Māori MPs and Labour won't have them in Parliament?
That's actually the message they want to give, because they're saying they, you know, most of them have got, all of them have got a good track record in this last term. Some have been around longer than others. They're all good, strong advocates on Māori policy, on Māori development, on improving the situations where Māori are overrepresented and shouldn't be, and they're going to stand on their own digs and say, "Yeah, vote for us. If you don't vote for us, we're not back." And that is the challenge that they're laying down.
But that sounds like you're blackmailing voters.
No, not blackmailing at all. I think there is the contest is between Labour Māori MPs and the Māori Party, and we are saying, we have said for some time, that after 9 years of the Māori Party being a coalition partner to the National Party, what have Māori got to show for it? Because a lot of things haven't got better. In fact, things have got worse. Māori home ownership has gone down. Māori unemployment has got worse. Māori health statistics, if you like, you know, what is happening to Māori health has got worse under this government. And so the claim by the Māori Party that they are this independent voice for Māori and will stand up and achieve things clearly is not true. We've got to have that debate. Māori and our Māori MPs are saying, we've got to have that debate. Māori have to have that debate, and this is the way of bringing that on.
So is this kind of just like a strategic move specifically set out to defeat the Māori Party and the mana?
It's to lay down the challenge to the Māori Party and mana and say, let's fight this on equal terms. We don't have a fallback position of a list placing. All we've got is the fact that we're standing here as a candidate in the seat, and Māori voters will have to make that choice, and that'll compel both sides to put the best case forward.
Mm-hmm. And you had the option of elevating your Māori MPs and putting them higher up on the list, but refused to do so. You don't think there's any chance this move will backfire on you?
I don't know where you get that proposition from. We haven't done our list yet. It's not due to be done till the end of April. What we do is, of our 7 Māori MPs, 5 are in the shadow cabinet and 2 are on the front bench. So our Māori MPs are well represented at all levels. In the end, what this comes down to is a choice, I guess, about, for Māori representation at the highest levels of government, is it going to be on the kind of grace and favour basis that the Māori Party has with the National Party at the moment? Or is it permanent multiple seats at the cabinet table and every cabinet committee, which is what a good, strong representation of Māori within the Labour Party gives?
What about in regards to Māori voters specifically? Like, does this not risk severing the strong link Labour's built with them over the years?
No, not at all. It actually, what it will do is strengthen it. Got to remember, in 2014, we increased the number of Māori seats that we held. We increased the level of support that we won from Māori, and we're determined to continue to build on that and continue to be a good, strong voice for Māori. And Māori, not just in New Zealand, but overseas as well. You look at what Calvin Davis has done for Māori who are being treated pretty shabbily in Australia. He's been there. So, no, this is about strengthening our connection with the Māori electorate, and that's what we're going to do.
Right. There was a major environmental report released this week, the OECD report, which has urged the government to act immediately in order to protect the country's water, native species and climate, and to stop stop favouring short-term private interests over environmental health. Do you think our current government's economic strategy has any part to play in these rising environmental concerns?
Oh, there's no question about it. They have actively promoted the greater intensification of farming. It's seen more nutrients being put on the land, which have been leaching into waterways. They've been very slow at doing the things that prevent that leaching into waterways, such as riparian planting. And they've taken a very lackadaisical view on it. So I think the OECD is... that's their observation. I think they're right. And if we want to turn that around, clean up our waterways, then there's a number of things we have to do. Labour is committed to doing it, and that is better managing the application of nutrients on land, doing the planting, making sure that farmers are investing in that, and over time, de-intensifying, particularly dairy farming.
Mm. And you did touch on this a little bit before. The report has highlighted the mismanagement of New Zealand's water as a key concern. What are your thoughts on the matter, especially in the wake of Nick Smith's recent comments regarding water quality definitions and measurements?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's tried to redefine what swimmable is by saying that, by just defining that it allows for a higher level of E. coli, one of the worst bacteria you can have in water, which is crazy. We, you know, if we're going to clean up our waterways, we have to have a proper standard that regional councils and landowners bordering those waterways have to meet, and that's what Labor is determined to do. The issue has come, it's sort of come into sharper focus with the water bottling issue and the calls by various communities for water bottling companies to have to pay something towards the water that they're extracting. And because associated with that is the availability of clean water from other sources. And I think a lot more New Zealanders now are seeing water is precious and we do want to preserve it and clean it up and keep it clean. And they want more action from government on that.
So do you think the government should review its planned $400 million investment in irrigation schemes?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the priority's got to be working on clean water, and in terms of activities that require intensive water use, if it is more intensive farming, then in the long term, that's simply not sustainable. So I think there is scope to review that.
Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned before, farming intensification has also been listed as a major risk to our green reputation. Is this report a call to reevaluate our farming practices in New Zealand?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first to do so. I mean, there's plenty of reports around calling out the more risky behaviours, if you like, of the farming sector. And in fairness, a lot more farmers now are showing greater awareness, are starting to do the things, and Fonterra is trying to work with farmers to get more planting and work with, you know, much more sophisticated application of nutrients onto pasture land. So that stuff is starting. The government needed to have done a lot more earlier and could still do a lot more now to encourage that and hasten that and improve farm practices.
So how will we transition to a greener, low-carbon economy under a Labor government?
Well, I mean, part of our economic challenge is to shift our economic profile away from this reliance on commodified agricultural products to more sophisticated, elaborately transformed manufacturers. It's an area where the Labor and the Greens line up very nicely. You know, the green economy has huge opportunities for modern, technologically savvy based manufacturing and, you know, niche manufacturing. So we want to do more to move down that path, which is much more ecologically friendly.
Okay, cool. So I think that's all we have time for today. But thank you very much for coming into the studio.
It's great to be in.
Yeah, great to meet you. And yeah, we'll speak to you again same time next week.
Look forward to it.
Yeah. We're just going to have a little break now, but up next, my producer, Jess, has a story on oil drilling.
We've been here for hours, Martin. Are you sure he's going to show?
This kind of La Nina system is the buzziest weather pattern known to man. There's no way he can resist.
Oh my god, it's Rick Breeze surfing the isotopes like a beautiful little weather angel.
Get the camera out. The tabloids will pay a mint for a snap of him in the flesh. What are you doing? Take the picture.
My fingers are all greasy.
Quickly, why'd you have to bring such a cumbersome old camera?
Oh, god damn it.
We'll get you next time, Rick Breeze.
No, you won't.
The weather. It's happening all around you most of the time, and no one understands it like the guru of gusts, Rick Breeze. Catch him every morning on breakfast with updates throughout the day to let you know if it's raining. Rick Breeze and the BFM Weather Report. Proudly brought to you by ProGear, professional photographics. Whether it's pissing buckets or somehow snowing on Queen Street, they've got the cameras and accoutrement to make all your shots primo. Check them out at progear.co.nz.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. The government has decided to allow oil drilling in 35.5% of the North Island's Maui Dolphin Sanctuary, as well as along the shores of picturesque Lake Te Anau and Fiordland National Park. The Green Party announced yesterday that this will create major risks for New Zealand's clean green tourism brand, as well as putting the already endangered Maui dolphins at risk. Earlier this morning, my producer Jess Smith spoke to Green Party spokesperson Gareth Hughes to find out more about the issue and began by asking about the government's announcement yesterday.
Well, the announcement was made yesterday by Judith Collins at the big oil conference in Taranaki, which was actually blockaded by oil-free activists. It's a massive size. We're talking about a size of area of the country of Papua New Guinea. And then they opened up 35% of the Maui's dolphin sanctuary. And then it's literally right on the shores of the pristine Lake Te Anau in the South Island. So, look, I'm outraged.
For sure. So what are the main risks for the Maui dolphin species, which is already endangered, if this drilling goes ahead in their sanctuary?
Well, that's right. The Maui's is the world's smallest and most endangered dolphin. And when you open up their sanctuary to oil drilling, you risk the risk of a spill, you see the risks of boat collisions. But then importantly, during the exploration phase, they're letting off gigantic underwater noises, the so-called seismic surveying, which we know, thanks to science, that it can really harm marine mammals in particular. So there's a huge number of risks. And look, I just think a sanctuary should actually be providing sanctuary, not opening the door to oil.
For sure. What other risks are there for kind of New Zealand's tourism and overall image?
Well, we do sell ourselves on the world stage as clean and green. I was just looking on the 100% Pure website today. They've got a beautiful photo of Lake Te Anau. Just imagine we could be seeing oil rigs and oil infrastructure all over that if the government goes ahead and gives this permit away. So, look, the oil age is over. Let's move towards clean energy. But definitely don't put at risk the last Maui's dolphins and one of the most beautiful, pristine parts of the country.
Yeah, and do you think it's possible for them to continue with oil drilling without upsetting kind of the environment for the dolphins?
No, I don't think it's compatible to have a dolphin sanctuary and oil drilling and exploration.
Mm-hmm.
There's only maybe 55 adults left. We need to make sure they've got a shot at survival. The fact is, though, the world's turning away from oil. We've seen a whole bunch of giant oil companies leave New Zealand. We've seen a whole bunch of councils call for an end to it. We've seen universities and churches and councils divest from oil. So oil's definitely not our future. Instead, we should be focusing on clean energy.
And when could we see this drilling come into action?
Well, what's happened is the government's opened what's called the block offer. So now the oil companies will put in applications to pick up some of these almost 500,000 square kilometres of onshore and offshore sites. So the ball very much is in the government's court. Last year, there was only a single permit given because there was so little interest from the oil companies because of the low oil price. So maybe we won't see oil rigs on the shorefront of Lake Te Anau. I definitely hope not. And I think the only way the government can make sure it doesn't happen is to remove it immediately.
So just finally, what is your advice for National?
Well, my advice to National is the oil age is ending. As the former Saudi Arabian oil minister said, the Stone Age didn't end for want of stones. It was because we found something better. Exactly the same thing's happening now. We're seeing electric vehicles, solar panels, more types of renewable energy, and this is where all the investment's going internationally. So my message to the government is let's embrace the future, let's embrace clean energy, let's quit subsidising the oil industry with tax breaks and subsidies, and definitely let's not put at risk our last Murray's dolphins.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire.
After a very successful launch in 2015, The Bachelor New Zealand is back to grace our screens every Sunday and Monday nights, and the third season has promised audiences more romantic twists and turns than ever before. In a short space of time, it's become a reality television staple for most Kiwis, a national institution, if you will. Whether you love it, or you hate it, or you love to hate it, the truth is that we just can't get enough of it. This morning, I spoke to research manager at the Institute of Culture, Discourse and Communication at AUT, Dr. Philippa Smith, to develop a more critical insight into reality TV and what exactly makes The Bachelor tick. I started out by asking why the more romantic subgenres of reality TV in particular tend to resonate with audiences.
I think that everybody likes the idea of love and connection and relationships. I mean, that's just a sort of a biological part of who we are. When it comes to watching reality TV and romance in that particular genre, it's a fascination. It's how do other people react? How do they respond? And in a way, we might want to identify with these people, but at the same time, we're very much open to criticising them as well.
Right, but is it kind of the content alone, or is it more the unmediated and the voyeuristic manner in which we get to experience this reality that's more enticing?
Well, I think basically, if we look at The Bachelor, it's a game, and we are part of that game. So the content raises lots of questions, you know, how real, you know, is it? But I think it's more the whole aspect of, you know, observation, being part of it. And it's all the social media and discussion, which becomes part of it as well. So it's, you know, attractive to people for multiple reasons, if you like. It's not all about love. It's about how do these people respond. How are they constructed by the producers, and we are the ones who get to discuss it and have public debate about it.
And also feel like we're kind of part of the story. Is that also another element of it?
Absolutely. I mean, and if you look at reality TV in general, when it's sort of grown out of sort of factual documentary, that the audience now has a much greater role. And we've seen those competitions where you vote people on and off. And while we're not doing that with The Bachelor in New Zealand, because those discussions are, you know, going online and in chat rooms and on Facebook and what have you, and even, you know, the media itself, so many articles are generated after each program, and opinion pieces. So, you know, to a certain extent, there might be FOMO if you're not watching. You might feel as though you're missing out. You're not going to be able to join in the discussion with your friends and others.
Yeah. And staying with general attitudes a little bit, there is this kind of wide perception that hating reality television somehow puts an individual in a morally superior position. And there are definitely legitimate critiques out there, but for the most part, like when you're talking about these think pieces, it seems like people just kind of love to hate. So are New Zealand audiences particularly cynical and critical of reality television, or is there a wider issue?
Well, I think New Zealanders have always had an ability to be critical of New Zealanders being on television. I mean, if we go right back to the sort of 1960s and 70s when TV first came, you know, into New Zealand homes, there was what was known as cultural cringe. We had so much television from the US and the UK, and if there was a New Zealand program, it was like, oh, you know, can't bear to hear that New Zealand accent, or, you know, we don't know how to do things. So from those very early days, there was that criticism then, but over the years, New Zealanders have grown to love seeing themselves on TV, and it is very much part of, you know, the cultural landscape. I would think that many other countries, people are also critical of, you know, their own reality TV programs. So New Zealanders are probably no different. But I think we do get the sense of a right to entitlement to criticise, because as we talked about before, it's sort of being, we become part of the game. And, you know, there are these New Zealanders who are putting themselves out there for everybody to see for whatever reasons. And, you know, we like to judge them or feel that we are entitled to judge.
Yeah, and our particular version of The Bachelor also seems to thrive on these painfully uncomfortable moments and these dating disasters. Do audiences have a capacity to root for unhappy endings?
Well, I think that's a good question because we definitely like the drama. I mean, that's what drives us. And already with the latest Bachelor, we're just beginning to see some of the personalities come out. And we're thinking, who's going to be the Naz of season three? So, you know, we want the drama. But, you know, just thinking about it, we also like happy endings. And so, you know, all that conflict can go on and we can criticise. But at the end of the day, we like it when, you know, things turn out. I mean, we have the fact that Matilda Rice and Art Green are still happily together. What I found quite sad with season two, that, you know, we had Jordan choosing Fleur and the next day that she gets dumped. So to me, that was the reality. That's what happened after the program. And I found that how that played out was actually, you know, very, very sad at the end of the day. So I don't think we like unhappy endings. We like the drama, but, you know, it's just natural for us to sort of go away and sort of have a feeling of happiness. And that's one of the things to do with reality TV, that we can sort of end on an up note if possible.
Mm, and Jordan was just entirely disinterested, I think, in the process. But you're right in saying, like, Art Green and Matilda Rice are kind of our poster couple,
yeah,
if you will.
Let's face it, you know, here you've got a bachelor who is given a choice of 19 girls to choose somebody who, you know, that they can have a connection with. And even in the program, you know, this week, they were talking about, you know, somebody who could be a future husband. I mean, talk about, you know, no pressure. But, you know, when you think about it, 19 girls, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're really going to find true love from just, you know, a cohort of 19 girls who have been selected for whatever reason. So, you know, I can definitely see the dilemma that the actual bachelor is put in as well. And in fact, I thought it was quite interesting in one of Zach's comments, which they repeated twice in the last episode. He commented, "It's like a pack of lions hunting a gazelle." He said, "I'm freaking out. Should I just run away?" And I'm thinking, yes, that sort of says it all. It sums it up. So I think it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, and now reality television discourse obviously centres around this fixation on authenticity. So as you mentioned before, we've got our leading man, Zach Franich. He's 28 years old, he's from Red Beach, and he's the head coach at a surf life-saving club. I'll be honest, he is like a little bit bland to me, but he does feel real. He's nervous and he's awkward, but he's earnest. What are your thoughts on him? Will New Zealanders embrace his authenticity? Like, how real does the batch feel?
Well, I think, and I've seen this with all of the bachelors, so I think there's, you know, some sort of training that goes on, and they're definitely chosen, you know, for their good looks. You know, when you say bland, he's got personality, he's got perfect teeth, he's got a lovely smile, but the way he talks to the various, you know, participants, he's very kind and he's very polite, etc. So, you know, the drama is not going to come from him. It's going to come, you know, from the woman on the show. So, it's interesting. He is the centre of attention, but it's how it's all going to play out around him, I think, at the end of the day.
Because with the second season, I think people found The Bachelor quite, for lack of a better word, bland as well, and a lot of the conflicts and the controversy had to be fabricated on the part of the production houses. Do you think there will be a similar thing here?
Well, I think there has to be. I mean, it's all about ratings at the end of the day. I think audiences are, you know, pretty savvy about reality TV, and we know that it's constructed. I mean, it actually surprises me that some of the women who want to participate do so, because particularly based on the previous programs, you know, they have no control at all over how they are conveyed. And again, I say they may be in the program for different reasons, for self-promotion, or, you know, perhaps they really want to have a bit of fun and, you know, do all that. But yeah, I think that there's actually, I don't know if you've seen it, a takeoff of this type of romance reality TV program called Unreal. It's an American program. And I just think that anybody, just watch the trailer of that, and you know, while it's a takeoff, it's perhaps at the end of the day, it's, you know, we want drama, we want nudity, we want, you know, shocked expressions. I mean, you can see the way that they focus on people's faces, or when there are those really awkward moments, and there seem to be plenty of them in this series, you know, suddenly you get that sort of quirky music which is reinforcing it. So, yeah, we know what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. Are there any other standout personalities to you amongst the women?
It's pretty early days yet, and I mean, you talked about, I think the show to begin with is a little bit bland because we've got all these sort of women to sort of assess, and there's only just some comments beginning to come through. So I think people will continue watching it, but it's really got to up the ante. But, you know, already we're seeing a sort of a little bit of the competition, the bitchiness sort of going on. This has come through with the language. So, you know, one of them said, "I want my time, I'm interrupting, can I steal you? You have to be rude, now's the time. If I don't get my message out there, then I won't have a chance." I mean, you know, this is all just bubbling under the surface. At present, there's just too many women for me to get my head around, so that's going to be up to the producers who they sort of make more prominent and put in particular positions. So, yeah, definitely a wait-and-see game, but it's got to happen for the program to be successful.
And speaking of this kind of inherent bitchiness, gender representation is a big point of scrutiny in reality TV, and The Bachelor is one of the biggest culprits. Do you think the show is kind of inherently anti-feminist, or does it just represent the changing face of feminist discourse?
I mean, I think the program in itself is a parody of romantic love. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the way that these women are portrayed and those messages that are coming through. So I sort of feel a bit sad that those sort of gender stereotypes, we haven't really moved away from a lot of that historically through this program. You know, you still got the role of the woman competing with others for one man's attention, for, you know, whatever it takes. There's this sense of, you know, a gift of a rose, or the fact if you get an opportunity to kiss the bachelor, behaving in this, you know, way means that you'll get a man's interest, and also the feeling that we must have a man to make ourselves feel complete. So I'd like to think that the public debate that goes on actually recognises all of that, and we definitely see that coming through. You know, Zach is the male, he has the power of the woman, but, you know, when we're critiquing the show, we can also critique it from a feminist perspective. And I would like to add that we get as a lot of sort of men critiquing it with a feminist discourse as well as women. So perhaps there is a positive side to all of this, but the way the women are portrayed, yeah, I think, again, it's
questionable.
It's questionable, those cringe moments. But that might be why people like to watch.
And, you know, it's interesting to note there actually is an article that they've chucked up on the 3Now website which says something like 17 reasons you can be a feminist and watch the show. So they are very self-aware. The show's also been criticised for its lack of diversity and for perpetuating the recentering of whiteness in popular media. From the three bachelors to their various female suitors to the mysterious entry of the white rose, everything is just overwhelmingly white, and it's not an accurate representation of New Zealand. So why does this keep happening?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a good point, because it's not just this program. I mean, we can look across media and we can look across advertising, etc. And there's that, you know, the domination of, you know, that white perspective. And that's something that, you know, people need to be challenged about. You know, it's just like, you know, the question, when is the first gay All Black going to come out? You know, we're just waiting for things to happen. And, you know, somebody's got to really make that first move. So, you know, I mean, it could well be a numbers game as far as, you know, who does apply to go on the show, and how people might be selected. You feel that, you know, there's one or two people with different ethnicities in the show. Is that tokenism? You know, it's
that
really
is tokenism,
hard to say,
isn't it? Yeah, it's not proper diversity.
Yeah, though. I mean, you know, let's get real. Yeah. Let's get real about it.
Yeah, I guess. And lastly, despite its many faults, despite the intense scrutiny it's subjected to, it has, since its inception, attracted viewers. So it always has, and it likely will for a very long time. Why is The Bachelor New Zealand so important to our cultural landscape?
Well, I guess behind it all, New Zealanders do like to see New Zealanders on television. We can take that cultural landscape literally. I mean, we have the settings of New Zealand, we have the, you know, the beautiful scenery, etc. And this is getting away from the actual romance side of things. It actually reinforces our national identity of who we are and where we live. And certainly I think it's important, you know, to have New Zealand content on television. I mean, that's always been part of the sort of New Zealand and they're wanting to promote, you know, more local content so that we get that sense of identity. And, you know, it's important, too, that we get people within the industry, you know, having jobs and learning skills and what have you. So, yeah, cultural landscape is important. We don't want to be dominated by American TV, UK TV, Australian TV. But, you know, having said that, I think if you did a content analysis, you'd find, you know, we're probably heavily weighted in that direction anyway, if you're taking in all the various platforms that we receive TV on these days.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.